with Emily St. John Mandel, who I said I would actually talk with you, and finally we have. Most recently, the author of The Lola Quartet. Emily, how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, thank you for having me on your show today.
Thanks for being here. I wanted to start off by pointing to something that is in your books that I find quite interesting.
Okay.
Or else I wouldn't have talked with you if you had written uninteresting stuff. No, anyway. you know, your books tend to start from this very interesting comic place.
Right.
Especially the last two. The Singer's Gun has this kind of almost office-like satire.
Kafka-esque situation in an office tower. Right.
Exactly. And with this one, it's sort of similar with the whole journalism racket and all this.
Right.
But it's not just related to situations, it's also related to sentences, like from Singer, the imposter who was chewing gum looked at him distastefully. Nice cornball there.
Thank you very much.
I approve. And then you also have the dry manner in which you describe Gavin. He's the journalist we were talking about. His fairly unrewarding life in the Lola Quartet. Gavin submitted the story, went home to eat takeout food, and stare at his television. He didn't sleep well. Very delicious dry irony there. And it's interesting because once we establish this routine, okay, we're in for a good time. And then, as we go further in your books, Emily, we see twists and turns and intensity and violence and duplicity and identity swapping and so forth. And that comic tone that sucks us in, or that perhaps entices you as a writer, sort of dissipates. And so I'm curious, you know, do you need to have this sort of strange Emily world of absurdity with which to start any particular book? How does this happen? I'm curious.
That's a very good question. You know, I think it might have a lot to do with my writing process, which is that I never know how a book's going to end.
Oh, yes.
So I'll start out with a premise, which in The Singer's Gun was, what if a man left his wife on their honeymoon? So, you know, the premise raises questions, and then in answering those questions, the plot starts to come together. And then with The Lola Quartet, I was really obsessed with the Jason Blair story, and I knew I wanted to write about that journalist. And you know, I had no idea how the book was going to end. So, yeah, you know, it's interesting. I guess I'm trying to be understated. You know, I'm trying not to reveal that this is going to be a high-stakes drama with, you know, a lot of maneuverings and plot twists at the beginning. So that might be part of it.
Yeah.
It's an interesting comment.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering if you need some sort of fun arena, fun area, because you have to be jazzed going into it. And
right.
From there, you can trust your emotional instincts to turn
see
over
where it
the
goes.
Text.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, how does this work? I mean, if you don't know where you're going, do you feel indebted to the initial feelings that you clearly you don't, I would say.
Right.
So how do these novels wend their way into what they went into?
Right. That's a good question. You know, going back to the first point, I think part of it is that I really just want to suck you in. You know, The Lola Quartet is very consciously structured in that way. So it starts off with that hook of a chapter. It's about three paragraphs long, and you find out that the 16-year-old girl with the baby has $121,000 strapped to the bottom of the baby carriage. So, you know, the idea is that you want to keep reading. And I think the variation in tone has something to do with that, too.
Yeah.
I think I kind of want to lull you into a, I don't want to say a false sense of complacency. That seems a little bit unfair. But I want to draw you in. You know, I want to draw my readers in. So, yeah, that's a big part of it.
Do you think this also accounts for the fact that you often have numerous characters who show up, and of course, you know, their identities always switch and so forth, that this is the way to constantly shift the terrain in your books and also to keep you writing these books? I mean, do you have that mushy middle problem when you are writing these, like a lot of writers do, or do you feel that the world that you set down changes enough so that you can sustain the story and never really grow bored with it?
This might not speak very well of me as a writer and as a planner, but I just keep switching points of view to keep myself interested, you know, and partly because I love what you can do with a story when you're telling it from different people's perspectives and the different people don't know what the other person knows or their memories or their experiences. So, yeah, I think a lot of it's about keeping myself entertained as I write.
Yeah. I want to actually sort of approach your work from a different angle. In aspects of the novel, E.M. Forster, of course, says, well, write what you know.
Right.
But he also offers this particular qualifier. Okay, write what you know, but if what you know is something you've only dipped your feet into, perhaps only a hand... I'm mixing my metaphors. If you've dipped your feet into the topic only a few times, then your writing is going to be fresh, it's going to be energetic, it's going to be vivacious, and you can keep something going. Whereas if you're writing from a place of exquisite expertise, it's going to possibly not be so fresh. It might be a little stale. I'm wondering, because you seem to have this knack for uncovering systems, real estate in this book,
right?
Trafficking in your last book. Right. You know, is this sort of how you approach the kind of systematic angle, the sort of secret world you want to attach to the massive plot? I mean, how does this work for you in terms of, like, finding out all this shit about what you're about to write?
It's a good question. The way it works is I'll start with a book. So I'll start with a premise, I should say, or something I want to write about, like a disgraced journalist or a man who leaves his wife on their honeymoon. And, you know, I read a lot, kind of compulsively. You know, you just follow link after link on the internet late at night. And what I found with all three books is that the random fascinations that I've had at the time of writing kind of start to adhere themselves to the plot. So, you know, I'll start a book about a disgraced journalist, and then I'll read a really fascinating story about Florida's exotic wildlife problem. Yeah. So I know I want to write about that, too. And then I'll read about foreclosed real estate. And because I don't know how the book's going to end, I can just keep on working those things into the plot. And, you know, I assume at a certain point it would become wildly overloaded. You'd have to pull back. But
has this been the case for all three of the books where it really reflects where you happen to be reading at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, wow. Yeah, wow. So Dead Languages and Last Night in Montreal.
Yeah.
Human Trafficking and Passport Fraud and The Singer's Gun.
Yes.
I also have to say I was influenced by The Wire. And the Singer's Gun.
I wouldn't guess.
Yeah, exactly. I know, a shipping container full of girls.
Yeah.
It's original.
Well, I mean, you know, this leads me to wonder, I mean, if you are committed to the path of knowledge that you are following, then have you considered perhaps straying from that path? I mean, you know, what do you make up when you are putting together, say, a trafficking ring or a real estate, hey, we're going to pay you X amount of money if you get the hell out.
Right.
I mean, you can't always tangibly be there. And maybe there might, in fact, be a danger of being too much there in your reading and so forth. So what do you do to protect yourself from being too steeped in something?
That's a good question. You know, I make a lot of stuff up. Like, I don't really feel like I'm an expert in any of these subjects.
Yeah.
You know, I'll read the initial article. It'll fascinate me. I'll read some more online, I'll follow some links, but I assume I've made enormous errors in all three books.
Yeah.
Some of them I know about. I found out that there's a real Sebastian, Florida that's in a different part of the state.
So yeah.
That was kind of embarrassing. But on the other hand,
it's fiction. Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, and there's a car that doesn't exist in Last Night in Montreal.
Which car?
You know, it's funny. This shows why you should always Google everything.
Yeah.
I had these vivid childhood memories of our family's first car being a blue Ford Valiant. And that memory was so strong that I didn't bother to look it up. Well, it turns out the Valiant was made by Chrysler.
So, I see.
Yeah, so, you know, 8 or 10 people have helpfully pointed that out. But
on the other hand,
it's fiction.
Yeah. Look, I will always remember the Durango 95 from Anthony Burgess' The Clockwork Orange, or rather the cinematic version of it. It just, for whatever reason, leaves a huge thumb out. And therefore, it's possibly more real than any car I've driven in my life.
Right.
Well, that's quite interesting. I mean, speaking of cars, I wanted to ask you about the one common metaphor I have seen in the last two books, the trail of red taillights. And it pops up in this one again.
Oh, does it?
It does.
Oh, you're right. I've got taillights disappearing down Park Avenue in the Singer's Gun. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, you know, I was going to ask you about this because should any writer repeat an image that is fond to her over the course of several books? What do you think about that?
I think they probably should, and I think I did that by accident.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, what is it about the red taillights that draws you?
Yeah, there's something kind of beautiful about them.
Yeah.
It's a little wistful. They're all going away.
Do you own a car?
I do not. Oh. No, I've never learned how to drive.
Cars tend to, clearly are an interest of yours, I think.
To some extent, yeah. The cars are more that they're a little bit inevitable when you're writing books or set outside major cities. You know, you have to move your characters around somehow.
I totally skimmed over the most interesting part. You never learned how to drive.
I never did.
Oh, really?
No, so in Canada, I'm not sure if it's the same here. You get your driver's license at 16.
Yeah. Same here.
Okay, yeah. So when I was 16, I didn't really have access to a car because my parents used their cars all the time for their work. And then when I was 18, I moved to Toronto.
Yeah.
So at that point, you know, I was 3,000 miles away and in a major city with a transit system. And I've just lived in big cities ever since. So it's never really been a desire or an opportunity.
It hasn't been a desire.
It hasn't been a desire.
I mean, I only drive if I have to go from city to city, but going on that road trip and cranking up music and just going 90 miles per hour down a highway, it's a wonderful sensation.
Right.
You're missing out, Emily.
But I love being the passenger in those situations. Oh, okay. So, yeah.
Yeah, but driving, you have the control.
That's an excellent point. Maybe for next book tour, I should.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So you've had no desire to get behind the wheel. I mean, this must affect your view of cities and your view of places, do you think? I mean, that you...
Yeah,
maybe there's sort of a... Maybe go get the Guide de Bord if you like.
Right.
You know,
I
know you're a big walker and so forth.
I
mean, do you feel that not driving or not having a desire to drive gives you a connection with a place that, say, hardcore drivers do not? What, have you thought
That's
about
interesting.
This?
I hadn't thought about that. You know, I just, I'm not crazy about car culture.
Yeah.
I grew up in a very rural place where you needed a car to get anywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've visited a few cities where you needed a car to get anywhere. And it's just, it makes your life so inactive
yeah.
in a way. You know, I know a lot of people whose only real activity is going from home to the car and then from the car into the office and
yeah.
then vice versa at the end of the day.
Yes.
And I just prefer to be more, I don't want to imply that they're not engaged with the world, but
yeah.
my preferred form of engagement with the world is doing a lot of walking and being out among people.
And the reading time on the subway, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. I also wanted to ask you, I mean, you know, going back to story structure, what's fascinating is since you don't know exactly how it's going to end out, these books are very neatly arranged in parts and so forth. And I'm wondering how you get yourself into such a concrete and very specific structure out of madness and anarchy. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I mean, are you like the world's most anal organizer? Are you? Will I find you at the Container Store?
You will not. No, my office is a disaster. It's about a year to a year and a half of hardcore revision.
Yeah.
You know, I just do round after round after round and try to make it as impeccable as I possibly can. So my first drafts are always chaos. And I find that, I found this with definitely the last couple of novels, that at the point where I have a complete first draft, I'm only about halfway through the process of writing the book. There's a good year to 2 years ahead of me you know, just chiseling away and rearranging sections and putting it together. So that's where you get that structure.
Yeah. Do you prefer the revising part over the drafting of the
Absolutely.
Initial?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I figured.
Yeah, it's so nice to have something to work with. You know, when you're drafting, you're really kind of flailing around in the dark. And, you know, at least I don't know where the story's going.
Yeah,
and you don't know if it's going to work out. But revising, you've got a concrete thing to work with.
What do you do when you've possibly worked over a page too much? Has this ever been an issue with you that perhaps, you know, a sentence is too clean for its own good? Anything like that?
I don't feel like that's happened to me. Not to be arrogant, I just it says, you know,
wow.
my sentences are so messy.
Listen, if he was over there, you're perfect.
No, it's more that my sentences are so messy in the beginning that they need it.
Yeah. Well, what tends to give you the most trouble in a sentence out of curiosity, or a particular story element? Is it you know? I mean, did you have any problems with the Lola Quartet at all? I mean, especially since
right.
you're balancing so many characters, was one
right.
character harder to imagine or devise than, say, you know, the other one? I mean, because Gavin seems like very clear to my mind.
Right.
What about some of the supporting characters?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I had a hard time with Anna, the 16-year-old.
Yeah.
I just, I have a hard time, I guess, connecting to my 16-year-old self, or I don't know very many 16-year-old girls.
Yeah.
That kind of felt like writing a foreign species. Which, you know, I hope she doesn't come across as awkwardly as she felt to write. But yeah, she was the hardest, definitely.
Well, did you consider talking to 16-year-old girls?
I did. You know, I read their blogs.
So
I know a few of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, and even another problem you run into is that it's not like you want their speech to really sound like a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah. So you're more of, I would guess, the observing type, or the one who reads the blog but who doesn't actually want to have a conversation with them? Is that safe to
yeah.
say?
I think so. I'm the creepy, lurking person in the blog.
Wow. So, who knows what you've observed about me? I mean, you know, does this offer any advantage or disadvantage? I mean, have you tried talking with, let's say, more 16-year-old girls or having a conversation with the very people who you might be writing about? I mean, like, I'm not sure how you seek out
right.
human traffickers or creepy real estate people.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I spent a lot of time Googling how to buy a fake passport. And it seemed like every site I came across was a trap from the, you know, Homeland Security. It was like,
wow.
I don't think I should click this link. So, yeah, you know, I've never interviewed people with the goal of interviewing them in mind. I try really hard not to write about people I know or to at least not make them recognizable.
Yeah.
I do find myself incorporating things that I've overheard and you know, random people that I've seen throughout the day into my books.
Everything is fair game.
Everything's fair game. Yeah, as long as you don't, as long as nobody's recognizable, and I really do try not to write about people I know. So,
in light of some of the intensive and compulsive behavior in your book, I must ask: do you if you're lifting little anecdotes or funny little sentences from life? I mean, do you seek revenge or do you seek understanding? What's the
I only sought revenge once.
Oh, you did? Okay. I knew you had a dark streak.
All right, so in The Singer's Gone, there's a character named Elena, who's, I think it's her supervisor.
Yes.
I can't remember her name, but she's an amalgam of my least favorite boss and my least favorite coworker, with dialogue lifted verbatim from the boss.
Yes.
So that was kind of satisfying, even though neither of them will ever read the book, or necessarily know who they were. Yeah. But that's the only time I've done that. Otherwise, I try to keep it completely fictional.
Sure. Yeah. I do have to ask you, going to Gavin, you know, this failed newspaper man, the sort of Jason Blair archetype. Well, you know, I got to say, this is one of the long list of very diminished men who we see in your work. I mean, I can almost imagine him commiserating with Anton in The Singer's mm-hmm. Gun, Christopher the Wandering Detective in Last mm-hmm. Night in Montreal. Your men share these really fascinating qualities of thwarted desperation.
Right.
And very often you pit them with extremely fierce women. And I love this.
Good.
But I do have to ask you, I mean, you know, why are you so fond, do you think, of having these kind of, you know, sad sacks paired up with these women who could just tear them to pieces in an instant?
That's a really good question.
You know, is this your way of making up for a century of patriarchal trappings? Or?
Absolutely not. You know what it is? I really like to write about extremely flawed characters.
Yeah.
And I don't know why this is, but I find it easier to write about men than women. And I think it might have something to do with their being
simpler.
No, it's more about distance. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's almost as if women are too close.
Yeah.
And it's, I can't get inside their heads because I'm one of them. And it's hard to have any distance at all.
You can't get inside your own head then.
No. It's
Wow.
Yeah, I just, I found men generally easy to write. And, you know, there was a review of my first two books, but it focused mostly on The Singer's Gun, that Gina Frangiello published in The Nervous Breakdown. And she made the comment that I tend to give men the best lines and, you know, set them up against these kind of impeccable ice queen women. And I read that and thought, God, she's right. I didn't do that on purpose, but she's absolutely correct. So that influenced the Lola Quartet to some extent.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to have more flawed female characters and
yes.
to give them better lines. You have Sasha, the gambling addict.
Yes.
And,
the compulsive yeah. gambling is really, really
gambling.
Intense. Yeah.
It's intense.
The whole
yeah.
scene with the scratchers and all that just is like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems like it's an inescapable gender issue here.
I don't know, but isn't Sasha more or less equivalent to the men like Gavin and Anton? I mean, she's...
Not to some degree, yeah. but I don't know, she just seems to have more going on and she's aware of her problem.
Right.
Whereas Gavin is completely lost in it. And maybe
he's
this goes back
to... lost in
the
beginning.
Yes, in the
yeah.
beginning. But, you know, maybe this goes back to the issue of getting inside the heads of men and not being able to get inside the heads of women.
Right.
Do you think that it's just easier to get inside the head of someone who doesn't exactly have a good grip on their head to
That's
really
a good question.
Sort of offer a very unusual phrasing for the issue?
Right. No, there's something in that. Yeah. Yeah, to get inside the head of a really flawed person is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you made efforts to get inside the heads of really sort of firm and fixed women that just have not made the cut for any of the three novels, out of curiosity?
That's a good question. Firm and fixed, meaning particularly stable and normal?
Yes,
or?
Yes. Or, I mean, let me phrase it this way. Have you tried to write a novel that had people who had a purely singular identity? No shifting, no double identity, no secret life. I mean, have you ever made an attempt to write something like that? Even a story?
No. I mean, perhaps a story.
Huh.
Yeah,
well,
that's interesting. I'm not doing
yeah.
it on purpose.
No,
that you mention it.
I know that, but I'm wondering
right.
why you think that is. I mean, you know, do you think that maybe if you committed yourself more towards a singular identity, you might be able to get in the head of a woman, perhaps?
It's possible.
It's possible.
Yeah. You
know, why not go over the
right.
cliff here?
No, I've definitely I've written very focused women. You know, she's kind of a villain, but what's her name? Who's the villain in The Singer's Gun? Aria.
Yes, Aria.
Yeah, people like that. But, you know, she has such an arch nemesis, it's hard to say that she's really, the paradigm of stability as characters go.
Why do you think you can't get inside your own head?
I mean,
most writers have no problem being just constantly introspective.
Right.
And yet, you know,
I am introspective. I just find it easier to write male characters. Yeah.
You're introspective, but maybe it's a situation where maybe writing is not the place for you to deal with what's inside your head. Is that safe to say?
That's possible. I mean, I don't write autobiographical fiction.
Yeah.
There was some element of autobiography in Last Night in Montreal.
Yeah.
But that was the only book where I've done that.
You think the world is too littered with autobiography and memoir, and you know you don't want to be part of that, or you feel you don't have enough of an identity here, or your identity is shifting identity?
Or I secretly sell fake passports. I don't want to blow my cover.
Yes. Or you're collecting information right now for some sort of intelligence agency as we speak.
Yeah, a triple agent.
Yeah. How do you know I'm who I am?
I don't. You shaved your beard from your Twitter avatar.
I shave my beard all the time, actually.
Sorry, what was the question again?
The question was, you know, basically whether you feel that writing actually, you know, that writing serves what's going on inside your head, fixing your identity.
Oh, the memoir. Too much
autobiography, memoir, etc. Yes.
I'm personally not usually drawn toward memoir. And, you know, there are exceptions to that. I really liked Cheryl Strayed's book, Wild.
Yes.
And I read an incredible memoir in the last year or so by Daniel, I'm going to mangle the pronunciation, something like Mastro Giacomo, the Italian journalist who was inducted by the Taliban. Yeah. But that set the bar pretty high. You know, I find myself reading these less extreme memoirs. And kind of thinking, you know, unless you're abducted by the Taliban, I'm not sure that the story's interesting.
Yeah.
Which sounds harsh. There are a lot of exceptions.
You know, it's the first world problems. Yeah. You know, how can any memoir compete with, like, oh, well, I'm sorry, I didn't have a life where I was raped by my uncle.
Right.
That whole thing, yeah.
Right.
But those stories are, I think, would, you know, have value, too. It's all in
Definitely.
How you tell
yeah.
it, and it's all in having a healthy curiosity about other people, which is why I'm asking you this question, why I'm stuck on it. It's like, you know, for someone who is so interested in how things work, I think you are, it's fascinating to me how, you know, there's this, you know, kind of diffidence in terms of memoir, in terms of, you know, expressing what's inside your head and so forth. And that's what I'm trying to get at here.
Right. Yeah. You know, I do like some memoirs. I read a lot of personal blogs. I find that's a really interesting way to kind of get these glimpses at other people's lives. And sometimes those won't be lives that we consider particularly extreme or particularly even remarkable.
Yeah.
You know, like friends of mine who are stay-at-home mothers. And on paper, that's a very ordinary thing to do. But just to see those glimpses and sparks and flashes of what their day-to-day is like is really interesting to me. So I do a lot of that. But, you know, overall, for long form, I find that I am drawn much more towards fiction.
Yeah. So you find that the way that, say, I guess a first worlder expresses herself through a blog or a Tumblr or something online is perhaps more true or more of an accessible hook for you to understand that person than either reading that book form or even possibly having a conversation or introducing yourself to her. Is that safe to say? Or?
You know, it's hard to say. I think it might be because I think about it and you have to know a friend pretty well for them to start really telling you what their life's like. You know, you meet somebody at a party and you get this kind of 10,000-foot view, to use a former boss of mine's phrase. But in blogs, something about that form lets people forget that there's an audience.
Yeah.
Or even if they're aware of it, they're thinking of it as this kind of intimate circle of friends, even though tens of thousands of people might be logging in to see what a three-year-old did today. So there is something about that format that I think leads itself to a more confessional approach. And you do catch glimpses of people's lives that you might not, even from talking to them for an hour. You know, it can be interesting.
You're looking for safe places for people to let loose unguarded thoughts and feelings which to draw on for inspiration for your understanding of humanity?
You make me sound awful.
Just to be clear, I think this is totally interesting.
Okay,
to a certain degree, I sometimes do this too when I don't want to leave the house.
Well, so, I guess I am in that I don't have my own personal blog, but I am reading other people's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh, that's interesting. And that gives you enough of a fix more so than, I guess, any kind of expression of your own aside from what you do in fiction.
I guess so. You know, I keep my own journals,
but
I don't publish those. I just don't have that blogging instinct to broadcast my personal life. I appreciate that other people do, because it's an interesting read, but it's never been me.
Well, I mean, what of this notion of the fact that, you know, really there's no privacy that people are spilling themselves over? I mean, it seems to me that you, like me actually, want to ascribe to the old way of doing things, where we have our own private places. We don't broadcast all the crazy thoughts and feelings that are going on in our head. Or, you know, if we do, we meet in regular places, hopefully without someone tweeting, hey, Emily Mandel just came to this party.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, what do you think this is doing to culture and also to fiction right now? Do you think this is posing a threat towards, you know, what some people identify as a serious problem. Like, America is not producing enough meaningful novels, or we have to go ahead and recruit, like, the Brits or the journalists. We have to have Hari Kunzru's Gods Without Men, or we have to have Catherine Booz be, you know, be behind Beautiful Forever. So,
right.
Yeah, so do you think this is a problem? This might actually be crippling the American identity? I don't know. I just kind of got off on this.
No, it's an interesting question. I think, you know, I don't think it's an American problem specifically.
Yeah.
I think it's anybody with an internet connection could be pouring their innermost life out. And I guess it's a lot of just personal preference. Like, I really want my private life.
Yeah.
And I had an experience a few months ago. I met a Twitter friend for coffee up near where I work, which is at a university in Upper East Side. And this friend of mine said, oh, my wife was wondering, you know, so you work in publishing, but you're on the Upper East Side. And I kind of felt like I'd succeeded. It was like, yes, I've been on Twitter for 3 years and nobody has any idea where I work.
Yes, so
I do like to keep my private life private, you know, and it can be a fine line because you get to the point where you're promoting books, for example, and then, you know, you're maintaining a social media presence. And you want to be an authentic person, you know, who's not just blabbing on and on about literature and go buy my book and the rest of it. So you want to bring your personal life in to some extent.
Or even worse, the constant person. There's that, Corey Archangel did this trend where he basically took every single reference of working on my novel on Twitter and is now collecting it for this project of his. And I just thought that was, it was both kind of me, but also kind of true. I felt emotionally conflicted about it, but this is what we're talking about, this is getting in the way of living.
It can get in the way of living, and I don't know that you want to be broadcasting what you're doing all the time. You know, there's something a little creepy about that to me. Like, Foursquare, seriously, freaks me out.
I know, it really does. Weird. I have not used Foursquare
once.
Me
either.
Well, you know, dude, to a certain extent, does this also extend to having any kind of place in the literary world? I mean, do you think that for you to create persuasive verisimilitudinous fiction, that you have to do so without this constant intervention of the party circuit, or, you know, having to be the some sort of darling of a particular subculture and so forth? I mean, you know, how do you negotiate this role in your life?
Right. You know, that could be hard for people living in Brooklyn. Because let's face it, there's a party every night. Two parties every night.
And then you become you become known as a misanthrope if you don't, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, at this point, this is really bad because we all should support our fellow writers and go to their events.
Yeah.
But I probably go to about one event a month, tops.
Yeah.
And it just comes down to time. It's like, you know, I have a part-time day job, as a lot of writers do.
Yeah.
And so am I going to stay home tonight and write the next book, or am I going to go to a party? And,
yes, exactly.
You know, you can only go to so many parties before the book starts to suffer.
Sure.
So,
So you're a master time management person as well.
I try to be really careful. I'm not great with time management. Yeah.
How do you manage things?
I turn off the internet.
Of course.
Yeah, there's that program that everybody uses, Freedom.
Yes.
It's $10, and God, it's more than worth it. You know, so I'll turn the internet off for 6 hours at a time over the weekend, and it's a well-named program. You kind of do feel free.
Yeah,
it helps a lot.
Exactly. Oh, actually, this may go back to my question about the River of Red Taillights. But you very often in your books have characters who have their handshake, and oddly enough, in trepidation and in nervousness. And I was getting into an argument with a friend, a very interesting argument, and I'm not even sure where exactly I stand, because I'm kind of swinging both ways. I'm being willfully bipartisan on this issue. But basically, the issue is this. If you go ahead and depict a character constantly having her hand shake, do you feel that that is either a fair shorthand for conveying the nervousness, or do you feel some sense of obligation to depict more of the spectrum of behavioral reactions in relation to nervousness? What are your thoughts on this? Because you do have a lot of handshaking in this.
Yeah,
I know. I know. And I'm not necessarily knocking it. It's just that's just what it is in an Amelie book.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting. I guess my hands must shake when I'm nervous. They do, actually, now that I think about it. You know, I've always found it to be a useful shorthand. I didn't realize I was doing it quite that much. But, you know, you can either say she felt nervous, or you can say her hands were shaking. And, you know, one's a little more elegant than the other.
Yeah. Well, have you thought of, like, you know, like a bead of sweat poured down her forehead or something along those lines? Just any other kind of...
I've done a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Gavin starts to feel a chill. In the climactic scene in the Lola Quartet.
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, while we're on the subject of Gavin and heat and so forth, I have to ask you about this. I mean, I know that, you know, you became fascinated in Florida, and that's what sort of dictated his condition. And yet, during the scene where he is actually outside of the motel room, I became acutely aware, at least the notion in my mind just popped up, oh, this guy's a vampire. I mean, you know, he right. cannot actually exist in daylight.
Right.
this just shows you, again, you're going to get a weird-ass, you know, interpretation from this, a guy like me. You know, what was fascinating to me is, like, I realized, like, okay, so this guy preys upon what other people are doing and not needing to know exactly where they have been in their lives the way that a vampire actually preys upon blood. And I'm wondering, you know, did you style Gavin as a kind of vampire in any form? How did the whole heat situation develop and so forth?
You know, that...
And also that, and also, I'm also thinking this in relation to the, to be clear, the dripping water in the apartment, which I know comes from personal experience.
It does come from personal experience. Yes. You know, both those things are actually kind of autobiographical.
Yeah.
I was raised in a very temperate climate.
Oh, wow. So you'd have suffered heat strokes?
I have trouble with heat.
So you're a vampire, and you're going to suck my neck at the end of this.
Yeah, this is the moment I was going to tell you. Oh, yeah.
Well, it's a good thing we're meeting during the day. You're maybe only a half vampire.
Yeah. So I sparkle in daylight. Otherwise, I'm good.
Don't get me started on dark shadows.
Okay. Yeah, I'll stay away from vampires.
Yeah,
I have had heat stroke a couple of times. And I thought it would be an interesting thing to write about. A guy who's from Florida, but absolutely cannot exist in that climate. And yeah, the dripping bathroom thing is completely autobiographical.
I had
an apartment when I was 18 with a plumbing problem. And it started to rain indoors. And it became this surrealist situation where it was raining in my bathrooms. I always knew I wanted to write about that.
But I'm wondering if you actually consulted, say, someone like Stoker for Gavin, or whether
I
there
didn't.
Might...
No.
Is this just the inevitability of working in some degree with genre materials in a literary fashion, that sometimes there might in fact be a parallel to, I suppose, a vampiric quality?
You know, I don't think that's it. Just to place it in context for anybody who hasn't read the book.
Sure.
The, you know, this quality you're talking about of preying on people a little bit and seeing... trying to figure out where they are at all times.
Yes.
You know, he's kind of styled himself after a private investigator.
Yes.
And he's looking for his daughter and his former girlfriend. So he's a man on a mission, you know, so it's not that he's praying for the, you know, for the sake of praying.
Yeah.
Let's say.
But for such a hotshot journalist, he never uses Facebook.
That's a very good point. No, but he does say...
that was the one thing I thought. I was like, you know, he's going through all of this, you know, knocking on doors and everything, but he hasn't actually checked anything online, really.
He does. He does say that Sasha is one of the disconcerting people who doesn't seem to exist on the internet.
That's true.
So,
that's
yeah.
True.
Yeah. Okay, he's done a little bit of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, where were we going with this? We were sort of talking about the vampiric similarities, and you know, I suppose journalism is in some sense vampiric.
I suppose writing fiction is too.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, the interesting thing is that his vampiric nature is also very pretend, and I'm wondering if perhaps a vampiric impulse is more interesting if it's actually a false one or a faux one.
Right. You mean in the way he's styled himself
as
a private investigator?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, he's a weird guy. He's, I feel like I've known people like this. He's kind of in the wrong decade.
Yeah.
You know, he really wants it to be 1925 and to put on his
fedora
and go out
thing.
Into...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Did you base this off of any specific person you knew?
Not really, no.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, I thought it was a really quirky touch, because, I mean, even for, I suppose, young journalistic aspirants, I don't know anybody who actually puts on a fedora and trench coat like that.
Right.
So it's an extremely quirky quality.
He's kind of an eccentric guy.
Yeah.
But I think he's probably not alone in longing for a previous age.
Yeah.
You know, you do encounter people who talk about longing for an age with more elegance. You know, when air travel wasn't hell and you could take liners across the Atlantic and that was a normal thing to do. And men wore great hats. You know, that's,
compulsive gamblers, journalistic imposters. I mean, how much quirk do you need to work with? Is there such a possible thing for you, Emily, as too much quirk in your characters? This is sometimes get in the way of fashioning and stylizing a workable novel. In any way, do you think?
I think there's definitely such a thing as too much quirk.
Yeah.
I haven't gone quirky enough for my quirk meters to go off, but But, you know, these things are subjective. It's not to say that other people haven't been like, oh my God, you call that a character.
Haven't you done a whack job on your own quirk, Emily? At any point during the revision? You know, it's like, it's too much quirk. We're taking them out.
No, nobody's tried to dequirkify my books, which I appreciate.
Dequirkify. It's a new word. Wow. Oh, yeah. I was curious where the name Sasaki came from, because I know, of course, there's a Japanese, there's an old emperor situation with that name.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, aside from the Django Reinhardt precedent, you know, what other jazz music historical examples did you mine from for this? Are cultural names of any use to you in finding the motivations of the characters?
Names? Not so much. You know, I've always picked names just on the basis of me liking the way they sound. Like, Sasaki is one of the most common names in Japan.
Yes.
I just think it's a beautiful name. I really like it.
It's what happens when a stutter orders liquor at a Japanese restaurant. Oh, sorry. Just occurred to me.
Yeah, and you know, so Gavin's older sister's name is Eileen, Ilo for short. And that's actually the only name that I've taken from life, really. I knew a girl named Ilo, short for Eileen, and I always thought it was a cool nickname, so I wanted to use it.
Yeah. So the beverage cues that are at the end of the singer's gun, like ginger ale for this, you know, certain beverages
right.
for that, it's one of those situations that makes me say, well, you know, this is Emily kind of playing with noir tropes, but also I have to ask whether this is something that you may actually do on your own sort of private time, whether you do in fact have specific cues for ginger ale and so forth.
No, but I should. That
yeah.
sounds like so much fun.
Where did that ginger ale stuff come from, the beverage cues? Is this something you just sort of thought
I just kind of made it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like that whole setup. Yeah, and just for context, if anybody hasn't read the book, so it's a setup that Gavin, the man who sells fake passports, has, of course, in the restaurant.
Yeah.
He is kind of in a conspiracy with a waitress.
Yeah.
And she brings the fake passports, and he signals her to signify whether the client's paid. Yeah, I knew they had to signal each other somehow, and I just thought it would be a cool idea to have it be a beverage.
It also leads me to wonder, like, how much physicality do you need in the scene in order to move it? Do you find, like, say, having ginger ale or an object or some, you know, whether it be a shower that has a leak or
right.
ginger ale, this actually helps you find the dramatic conflict in the scene? Or the, if you shake the topographical place up, then
right.
you might, in fact, produce some results that might, you know, give you an answer as to how all the pieces align.
That's interesting. I find it helps me establish the characters. I've seen how they react to the things in the scene and the things that are happening. So, you know, like, what does he do with the ginger ale? Is he fidgeting around on the table, or is it just there? You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Sort of related to my other question about, you know, can you write a character who has a singular identity? I'm wondering, you know, how conscious of you are, now that you've written three books, of possible repetitions and tropes or themes, and what methods you were presently using. I know you have a fourth novel that you're in the middle of, you know, to counter those. I mean, you know, what are you doing, Emily, to make sure that you are always putting out a distinct and novel, a new one, a different one, every single time? What steps are you taking?
It's a fair question. I think often you can write a book without realizing that you're repeating certain elements, even if they're small
yes,
elements.
Yes, of course.
You know, I finished the Lola Quartet, and I realized, wow, this is the third book I've written in which a troubled young man starts in New York and leaves immediately. Like, I didn't
yes,
do that on purpose,
yes.
but it happened. I think you just have to try to be aware of them.
Yeah.
You know, my fourth book's very different by design.
No troubled young man leaving New York?
No troubled man leaving New York. Narrative never touches New York.
Oh, wow. Where is it, actually?
It's
set, I don't want to test you too much.
No, it's okay. It's set mostly in Toronto and in northern Michigan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's hard not to repeat yourself. You get these, I guess there are ideas that you keep on developing. You know, I feel like Last Night in Montreal was a sort of self-consciously lyrical book. It was almost more about the language than it was about the plot. The Singer's Gun started to edge more into noir, and then I think I took it further with the Lola Quartet. So
yes.
I think it's fair to say there are some similarities between definitely the Lola Quartet and the Singer's Gun. And I'm just trying to do something completely different for the fourth book to break out of that. You know,
Well, if your characters can't sit still, then one can therefore say that, in fact, your novels are not going to necessarily sit still.
Right.
Why do you think your characters are always on the run? Is this just the way to sort of find out what they're doing and what their role is to the plot? Or?
I mean, they're not all on the run.
Yeah, I know, but
yeah,
a good deal of them are.
A good deal of them are. You're right.
Ranging from cross country in the first book to multi-continental in The Singer's Gun. And this one, there's not as much of it, but there is still some of it.
There is still some of it.
There is still the sort of West Coast refuge.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, I think we're all influenced by our lives to some extent in our writing, even if we're not making it autobiographical. And when I look back at my life, I feel like the most pivotal moments have involved travel.
Yeah.
You know, moving from British Columbia to Toronto alone when I was 18,
yeah.
and then moving from Toronto to New York, New York to Montreal, Montreal back to New York. There's been a lot of traveling, a lot of moving around, and in some ways it's those... journeys is the wrong word because it sounds so cheesy. Those travels, let's say, that have shaped me
journey.
To a large extent. Yeah. And so I think that's something that I keep on coming back to because I'm really interested in it, is what travel does to us. And
yeah. But you're not traveling so much now.
No, I've been in New York for 9 years.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. So what do you do to, I guess, find those formative experiences? Or are you past that stage in your life? Is that the stage you draw from your fiction, the travel days? Or
I have to a large extent. It's an interesting question. I'll have to see how the fiction changes the longer I stay in the same place.
Well, are you one of those authors who requires kind of like a statute of limitations? Okay, if I'm mining from something in my life, sort of, and it's not exact, but it's kind of close or parallel, maybe like 7, 8, 9 years needs to pass before I can actually safely find a concrete place for it in fiction. And even then, you know, obviously you can't control exactly how it pops up.
Right.
But maybe you need to chew on something for a long time before you're comfortable perhaps with transforming it in some sense to fiction. Is that safe?
Yeah, you know, that might be safe to say. I mean, the raining in the apartment thing is something I always wanted to write about.
Of course.
That happened when I was 18 or 19 years old. And, you know, this book just came out and I'm 33. So that took a while to come out. You know, and there are some things that I might never write about. Like, I used to be a dancer. That was
yes,
my first career.
Which you haven't even touched upon.
Right, right. And I've never felt any real desire to write about dance.
Yeah.
You know, they're just...
It goes back to Forster. Expertise in dancing.
Right,
exactly.
Right.
So why would you write about it if it's going to be stale? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think you should write what you don't know. That's what the internet's for. So
that's what the internet's for. Okay. That seems a really bizarre way to end this conversation. So I'm going to take it. Emily, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Fantastic. Okay.
In a club down in Old Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A, Cola.